This is an interview with Governor Victor Atiyah at his office in downtown Portland, Oregon. The interviewer for the Oregon Historical Society is Clark Hansen. The date is June 15th, 1993, and this is tape 35, side one. We were just beginning at the end of the last tape to talk about the 1982 campaign, your re-election campaign. And I was first wondering when you decided that you were going to run. What was the decision, and what was the decision?
The cycle really for decision would be all late in the year before. I don't recall when I made my formal announcement that I was going to run, but it needs to be somewhere, you know, you have to make a decision around October, early November, mm-hmm. that you're going to run next year. Mm-hmm. And it was about that time I'd made the final conclusion.
And I had down here my notes that there was a announcement of the formation of the re-elect Governor Atiyah committee in September of 1981, and you had on that committee you had Blake Herring and Leonard Gorsgren and Roy Livermore.
Yes.
Who are those individuals, and why did they form the core of that committee?
Well, backing up, Roy Livermore had been my treasurer before. He was a very meticulous, strictly honest individual. Mm-hmm. And there are things you don't need to worry, shouldn't have to worry about in a campaign. Certainly this matter of finances is one area, you know, because of all of the laws that are involved, all the reporting requirements, the timetable to doing all of those things, the recording of contributions and receipts that go out. You know, it's a pretty technical thing. Mm-hmm. And Roy was the kind of a person that I could depend on. I knew he'd get the law, he would read it, he'd read the regulations, he knew exactly what had to happen, when it had to happen. And so I was totally comfortable. I never worried about it. So that's Roy. Incidentally, I have an interesting story about him because he was involved in my first election as well. Mm-hmm. And Punch Green was, and I'm talking now about the general election, Punch Green was the co-chair along with Marge Russell. Marge Russell goes way back in my campaigns and is in the legislature. She's a good family friend, wonderful woman. Because Punch felt an obligation to Tom McCall and to me, he stayed out. But anyway, when I won, he came on the next day. The interesting story was that Punch was gung-ho, and we're going to have to raise, I've forgotten how much money, but, you know, we had a budget of money. Roy Livermore was very nervous about, oh, we can't raise this. I mean, this is, you know, being a conservative and accountant-type fellow. By the end of the campaign, it was Roy who was saying, you got to go get some more money, and it was Punch says, we can't get any more. The roles had been totally reversed. At this point now, Punch Green is back in Washington, D.C. I really missed him. I missed him, as a matter of fact, during my years as a governor. And we're looking for those that had been involved in campaigns who were familiar and having worked both in my campaign and with Punch, and, you know, had a good savvy. Leonard Forsgren was a dynamite fundraiser. He had been and is well known for in politics. Very nice man, but, you know, he really knows how to go about raising money. Mm-hmm. Blake Herring is a really nice guy. I like him. He's a good man. Not the stature of Punch Green, but at least sort of followed in those footsteps. Incidentally, Leonard has just recently passed away unexpectedly, a relatively young man. Blake Herring, who then had his own business, is now working in Norris Beggs and Simpson, whatever that is. And,
real estate?
Real estate, building management, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You, at that early point in 1981, you had listed as your possible Democratic opponents as Jim Weaver, Neil Goldschmidt, Don Clark, and Ted Kulongoski. why did you list them? Obviously, Ted became your opponent, and Neil was a always sort of there in the wings. But especially with Jim Weaver and Don Clark, had they mentioned the possibility of running for governor?
No, you just kind of look over the scenery and mm-hmm. think who are the potentials for such a thing. If I had my choice, I'll tell you for the tape and history, I would have wanted Neil Goldschmidt.
Really?
Yes. I would have wanted Neil Goldschmidt. I really wanted to campaign against him. Very much wanted to campaign against him. Obviously, that's not the way it worked out.
Why?
Well, you have to ask him. I have no
idea. No, but why did I want it?
Oh, I suppose a matter of ego. You know, he's a fair-haired guy and up-and-coming Democrat, and he stood for a lot of things that I just didn't think were the right things. And I'd like to, you know, had debated all of those during the course of a campaign. We already covered the Mount Hood Freeway and a few other things. So, you know, it's just one of those things. I think but it didn't work out that way. So.
I had down here somewhere, that's an interesting comment, because I had here somewhere in my notes that actually Kulongoski, I think it was one of the papers that mentioned it, said that it was an interesting campaign running against Kulongoski because it was the first time, oh, here it is, yeah, well, it was Willamette Week that said it, something not seen in Oregon for three decades, a classic labor versus business confrontation. Do you see it as that kind of classic polar opposite type of confrontation, ideological confrontation?
No. We did use constantly in our reference to Ted Kulongoski. We wouldn't say Ted Kulongoski, we would say labor lawyer. So we used that frequently. That was part of our script. Mm-hmm. But in terms of labor and business, that was the clash. I never thought of it that way. He did things, obviously, that were destructive to business, in my mind. I didn't sit down and sort of classify the race that way. Mm-hmm. I had different thoughts in mind, you know, in terms of how I observed the campaign, what I intended to do, that kind of thing.
In the early endorsements that came out, one thing that was interesting was that the Columbia Pacific Building and Construction Trades Council ignored the FL-CIO and backed you. How was it that they were able to do that? It seems like bucking that organization would have been a pretty difficult thing.
I had good support from the craft unions, mm-hmm. and although collectively AFL-CIO as such didn't endorse me, there were you know, separate unions that would have the courage to go ahead and endorse me. It took a lot of courage for them to do it. A lot of courage.
Okay.
It's like my good friend Bill Fast, who was has been a labor, let's see, it's a maritime union, I'm trying to think of what it is. And Bill really took an awful lot of flack, because he was not only endorsing, he was actively working, you know, in behalf of my candidacy. Took a lot of beating for it. I admire that kind of thing. That's tough to go against, the tide in your own peer group.
Maybe you could describe a little bit your relationship with the Teamsters and how you viewed them in terms of the upcoming campaign.
The Teamsters, nationally, as we all know, have a very bad reputation. Corruption and all kinds of things of that kind, even suggestion of crime. I didn't view it that way in terms of Oregon Teamsters. So you can't, just incidentally is a good example of not painting everyone with the same brush. LB Day represented Teamsters. They were a very responsible group of people.
LB Day was working for your re-election too, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, so I separated, just like I would separate the AFL-CIO leadership in convention against versus the members of organized labor. I've been around long enough to know that they don't pull the string for everybody. There are people are out there independent, and they're going to exercise their own independence. And that became clear, of course, when election day rolled around. That I've said so many times, the AFL-CIO did not endorse me. The Oregon Education Association did not endorse me. The Oregon Public Employees Union didn't endorse me. The Women's Political Caucus didn't endorse me, and I won by 62%. But you see, it's the same, you know, what I'm saying basically is that the leadership of those organizations is one thing, but I always knew that the people are not that militant, certainly not in Oregon.
Yeah. Were you trying to formulate a way of dividing labor up so that it wouldn't all go towards Kulongoski?
No. This is not a target area for me. Mm-hmm. I've been a great believer in, and I think we mentioned it before, not compartmentalizing people. Putting them in certain bags. These are labor people. These are senior people. These are, you know, whatever you want to pick out. That goes against my grain. I don't believe that's, again, we keep coming back to my own personal philosophy, but my philosophy is we're all Americans, and we shouldn't have to make those kind of separations. Like in my appointment of Jerry Thompson. Jerry Thompson, a woman. You don't need that, comma, a woman, end comma. Mm-hmm. Jerry Thompson is a person. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's where I come from. So the campaign wasn't geared to putting people in certain pockets and then appealing to them. The campaign was designed to talk to Oregonians and in the sense of what I believed to be their general feeling. Whether they're young, old, union, non-union, didn't make any difference to me. That was not my target. My target was to talk to Oregonians who wanted, and now you recall, we were at the very depth of our recession, mm-hmm. 12.6% unemployment. You know, they want employment. They want hope for the future. They want, a good stable government. They want somebody in government that really has the strength and the compassion to do the job that needed to be done. So it was up to me to go out and sell that message.
Mm-hmm. You were also endorsed Oregon Public Employees Union, weren't you?
No.
No, that was Kulongoski.
No, that was one of my big disappointments. I really mean that most seriously. Matter of fact, I will always remember that.
I see. Yeah, right. They endorsed Kulongoski.
Yeah.
Didn't they?
And it was a disappointment to me because I really believed I had done more good for them than anyone that I had ever seen, mm-hmm. any governor that I'd ever seen. And when I say that, it wasn't just a matter of pay. It was a matter of creating a career opportunity for them, to make them feel good about their job, to make them happy and working. It was a whole package of things. Someone said to me one time, "Have you ever been discriminated against?" Meaning, of course, because of my Arab background. I said, "No." And then I amended it. "Yeah, I have been." And they kind of raised their eyebrows. You kind of chuckle at it, and the others have, but mm-hmm. the point is that when have you seen the AFL-CIO endorse a Republican? Mm-hmm. Rarely. When have you seen the Oregon Education Association endorse a Republican? Rarely. And when have you seen the Women's Political Caucus endorse a Republican? Rarely. You know, here again, here's a man, meaning me, the first woman chief of staff in our history. When I started out, 7 out of my 10 top posts are women. And women in department head positions. And incidentally, I guess I didn't get the endorsement because I didn't do it in a token way. I did it in a natural way. Mm-hmm. So, and my own feelings, I did very well for labor. Certainly in my own views, I did very well for education. So, but you see, they couldn't get over that hurdle of this guy's a Republican. How in the world can we endorse a Republican? So anyway, the disappointment was the Public Employees Union. I will always remember that.
Who is or was Ted Kulongoski? How would you describe him?
I think he was generally described as, first of all, the up-and-coming Kennedy type, charismatic, you know, Camelot kind of guy. Well, I don't want to get too editorializing on that kind of a thing, but I think that's the basically, you know, sort of a vigorous young man with new ideas. Again, I described the hurdles I had to face. Here's this Kennedy type, vigorous kind of young man, you know, tie loose and all of this sort of stuff. Nice head of hair. Against this rather mundane, quiet, stuffy old Republican businessman, you know. And I had to get over that hurdle.
Who is describing you that way?
Non-charismatic, I have to add that.
And non-charismatic.
Oh, I don't think anyone had read it anywhere. I'm sure that was some of the early street talk.
Well, there were a lot of debates over debates, weren't there?
No. Well, there was, but only as to the shape of the table. It was very interesting. I said to my campaign staff, tonight, meaning primary night, tonight I'm going to challenge Kulongoski to debates. No, you don't do that. Tonight I'm going to challenge Kulongoski to debate. I am not going to go through this nonsense about are you going to debate, aren't you going to debate, a teal debate, Kulongoski. I'm not going to go through that. That's a lot of baloney. I am not going to do that. And so on election night, primary election night, I challenged him to debate. Now, the big controversy was from the media. They picked on it. Well, the dog days of, you know, August, and nobody's going to pay any attention. What's Atiyah doing? You know, here's a guy who is the incumbent challenging the challenger to do a debate. When was that heard of before? And instead of saying, hey, this guy's okay, no, he picked the wrong time to debate. You just can't win. Just can't win. I'll stop and tell you a joke for the tape.
Okay.
Maybe whoever's going to transcribe this might enjoy it. And the whole idea is you can't please people. You just, no matter what you do, you can't please them. The story is about the grandmother who was walking her grandchild on the beach. And this wave comes sweeping in and sweeps her grandchild out to sea. And she was horrified. She dropped to her knees and she began to pray, Lord, Lord, please return my grandchild. Young man, he's got a full life ahead of him. I love him so much. Please, Lord, return my grandchild to me, grandson to me. The next wave comes in and deposits her grandchild just very safely right at her feet. And she looks up toward the sky and said, he had a hat.
And the next wave probably took both of them.
So you see, you can't please them, no matter what you do. Anyway, that's it.
Well, there were still these reflections about the Morse-Packwood debates in 1968,
yeah.
and the primary debate of 1978 with McCall and Martin fighting while you were just sort of looking on.
Yes, yes. Remember what I told you.
Yeah. So, what was there agony on your campaign staff because of this? So they didn't want you to do it, did
no,
they?
But, you know, no, it wasn't that they didn't want me to debate. They didn't want me to challenge them on election night. But I just had enough of this nonsense over all those years, and I wasn't going to be a party to it. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe in terms of arguments as to where it was going to be and what was the format and who was going to sponsor, you know, those kinds of shape of the table kind of thing. But there was no question as a debate. Now, you also asked about how we were observed, or how I was, or how Kulongoski was. There was one comment in one of the papers, and I don't recall which. It might have been Foster Church. But anyway, somebody said, and it pleased me very much, Atiyah looks like the challenger, not the incumbent. That's precisely what I was doing. Mm-hmm. It's exactly what I was doing. I was not going to be that incumbent. I'm going to pause for a moment, because I told my staff time and again, always, that both 78 and 1982, being, as you know, my athletic background, and I've observed contests, particularly football, it's oftentimes basketball, where the team would be way out in front. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden it convert, and they begin to protect their lead. And that's when they lose. And I said, I'm not going to sit here and do that. I'm not going to do that. I'm going out. If you want to say take risk, I'm going to take risk. But I'm certainly not going to sit back and, quote, protect my lead. And so it was this aggressive style of mine that I'm talking about my own personal mental attitude. I'm running for re-election. I've got things I want to do as a governor. I'm not going to take any chances at all, I mean, of losing this race. And so I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to put aside all this nonsensical stuff about a debate and just shove that off to the side. I got other things I want to do. I don't want to argue about, spend my time and energy on arguing about debates. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I've told the press so many times, yeah, I said, this is a lot of nonsense. I read about how great this is for the constituent, for the voters, and mm-hmm. this is a wonderful thing. And I said, that's all nonsense. I said, you guys are here for the same reason the people go to the Indianapolis 500. They want to see a crash at the third turn. That's why they're there.
How did they respond to that?
Well, they chuckle because, you know, everybody recalls the Packwood Morris debates,
right.
And that everybody's looking for that little gaffe that's going to all of a sudden, that's what they're there for. That's what that's all about. Mm-hmm. And to me, it was just cosmetic stuff. It's part of the drama, but not part of the real campaign.
Your first debate was at the City Club, wasn't it?
Yes.
What was that like?
That's another good example of campaigning. I don't know if I've covered that. I think I may have. If I have, we'll just duplicate it. During the course of my debates, I knew that I was not talking just to the people that were present. And you have to keep that in mind. You know, you get absorbed by I'm talking to these people. But when you have two gubernatorial candidates, obviously it's carried by a lot of people. A lot of radio, a lot of television, a lot of newspapers. So it's going to go out. It's not going to stay in that room. Whatever you're doing is not staying in that room. And this is early in the campaign, our contest between each other. And so I'm saying, okay, I've got to kind of take care of some things. I'm not sure how it was reported, whether it was reported a tie or Kulongoski won. I don't remember. But it was no better than a tie or a Kulongoski won. It was never Atiyah won anything.
Uh-huh.
But Ted Kulongoski had taken a real shot at the farmers, talking in terms of the fact that they had abused their workers and the migrant workers, and it wasn't just a matter of that, but I've forgotten exactly the terminology, but he'd taken a real shot at the farmers. So now here we are at the City Club in downtown Portland. We get to ask questions of our opponent. So I'm asking Ted Kulongoski about his thoughts in regard to the farmers. Now, what I had in mind was to have him repeat for this great public audience this shot he'd taken at the farmers, which he did. So that sort of took care of the farmers, as far as Kulongoski was concerned. That strategy, and you see, no one would even notice it. I'm repeating it. I probably never repeat it anywhere in the newspaper. Nobody probably even right. noticed it, except the farmers.
Yeah.
So, I felt good about it. I felt comfortable in the process. I knew what I was doing. I knew where I was going. I knew what I wanted to get accomplished. And incidentally, campaigns are a sort of accumulation. What you say today is not going to do the job, but maybe you say it 15 or 20 times, mm-hmm. and then it begins to come across. And so this is all part of the pattern of trying to develop that message that you want to get across. But you have to know what your message is, and you have to make sure you repeat it, maybe in different words. I got tired. I mean, I had, when I say a canned speech, it really wasn't canned, but there was the text of a speech. But, you know, I it's not within me to repeat something exactly the way I'd said it before. I can't do that.
Would you generally make speeches like a formal speech with a prepared, a completely prepared verbatim text, or would you do it with notes usually?
In the case of the debate, the opening and closing, mm-hmm. well, the closing less so, although you have a framework for a closing, mm-hmm. but you don't know what's going to happen during the course of the debate. Mm-hmm. But the opening, of course, you do have. And so you sit down and figure that fairly precisely because you have a limited amount of time. It's always mm-hmm. you know, a certain amount of time you have to do that. And you want to make sure at least you set the stage for what you want to say. Mm-hmm. So that's usually a scripted in a sense. The closing may be a framework for closing, maybe a repeat of something that you said at the very beginning to sort of cap it off. But then you have to also be alert to the fact of what you may want to insert or finish. Sometimes you can't finish the answer to a question or something like that. I recall very, very well, it's interesting how these things, you know, I wasn't even interested in running for elective politics myself. But when I was quite young and Dewey was running against Stassen, mm-hmm. and this was the Oregon primary, and in those days, the Oregon primary was very big because it led into California, sort of a momentum thing out of Oregon. So candidates really wanted very much to get Oregon. And there was this debate between Stassen and Dewey. It was on radio, no television in those days. I don't recall the debate at all, but I do recall in the closing, and I'm going to paraphrase, Dewey had the last word. And in effect, he said, you see, everything I said was right, and everything he said was wrong. Now, obviously, that's a paraphrase. I said, you know, that's a pretty clever tactic. Because, you know, he's leaving the listeners, you know, he's got the last word. He's leaving the listeners for something. But debates are way over played in terms of a campaign and how successful a campaign is. We had three debates. You know, that's not very many in terms of debates. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, Bush had, what, three or four, maybe. Again, that's not much in terms of, that's one day. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of days in between.
But isn't the spin from those debates important?
No, not really. A debate is just one more element of what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. It's part of what you're doing. Mm-hmm. It's more of a continuum rather than a moment in time in which you're going to blip up or blip down. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just sort of a continuum. Again, it depends on how you look at it.